You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are Talking
While Married. Well, good evening.
Well, good evening, Mrs. Martinelli. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, you know, this morning you and I had an opportunity to have breakfast together, which we don't often have that opportunity. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about at breakfast has been on my mind a lot today.
Well, first of all, full disclosure, the reason it isn't that we're not together, it's because we're just so darn busy.
We don't
have time to run out to the restaurant and get some breakfast.
It's just grab a cup of coffee and go kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't want people to get the wrong idea here.
Well, anyway, we were talking about homelessness. And, you know, how this came up was that we were reading an article about San Francisco, and actually about four places, Seattle, San Francisco, Portland, and Los Angeles, who have huge out-of-control homeless problems right now. And actually, even in San Francisco, what's interesting is that they actually have a map that they call like a poop map.
Oh, yeah.
That shows all the areas kind of to avoid because there's so much feces on the streets.
What other major metropolitan city in the United States can you think of that actually plots poop?
Well, and San Francisco, being historically just a city that people love to go to travel to, has turned into a nightmare to travel to. But that's beside the point. The point to me on the whole homeless thing, as I think about it, is they have spent a lot of money on this problem in the four places that I mentioned. And not just the four places, but that's what I'm going to talk about right now. So Seattle has spent $1.2 billion that they've thrown at this problem, only to see it get worse and increase.
Los Angeles, I just read, those people have agreed to tax themselves to the tune of just about $5 billion, $4.6 billion over the next 5 years.
Well, 1.2, again, of that in 2016 was voted on to build 10,000 new
housing units
correct, for the homeless. And to date, and we are in 2020, 4 years later, virtually nothing has been done on that. So my question that started kind of bugging me and being on my mind is, where is all this money going? Because all of the places I mentioned, Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, have thrown billions of taxpayer dollars, supposedly, at this problem. All four places have gotten nothing but worse. And the homeless population has exploded. The problem with illness has exploded. The problem with needles and crime has exploded. The residents are sick to death of it. And what I want to know, Ron, and what every person in America should know, especially in those cities, where did that tax money go?
Well, I think we should talk about that. Now, some of the things, of course, that I'm reading and doing research in this area is that they are hiring people. Okay, so they're putting together groups of people that are being trained to go out, make contact with the homeless, do demographic studies, do things like this to try to identify, you know, who the homeless are. And as a criminologist, I totally get that because I've done those same, they're called ethnographic studies. I've done the same thing in the city of San Jose and also in Santa Barbara that hired me to do that. So part of that is going to that. But, you know, I just wanted to take a minute and I wanted to give you some statistics on the county of Los Angeles. And that's where you're from. And I'm born and raised in San Francisco. But let's talk about where you're from, which is the Los Angeles area. In the last 6 years, they've seen a 75% increase in homelessness, and they're up to nearly 60,000 people. They're actually around 58, if you know, take in a couple of the outlying, you know, suburb areas, and they're up from 32,000 in 2013. They found that three out of four people in Los Angeles live in cars, live in campers, live in lean-tos, live in tents, and just kind of put together shopping cart, homeless, what do you call it, houses that they put together with blankets and stuff
right,
like
they're
that.
Yeah, right, they're ramshackle little
places. But that's three out of four. And the problem has gotten so much worse since Eric Garcetti took office as the mayor. They found, just this last month, they found 222 encampments that had between 50 and 100 people living in them. 222 encampments, and we're just talking about the city of Los Angeles. And now, and you and I have seen this when we go into SoCal, and we've even seen this in Orange County. And that is, all of a sudden, they take the bus shelters, and they take the train shelters, and they take any kind of shelter, and they turn it into their own personal houses. And the whole place smells like wine and, you know, decaying wine and feces and urine. And it's absolutely incredible. Now, here's something that's interesting that I didn't know. When Los Angeles is compared to other major cities in California and across the country, it ranks at the very bottom of cities that actually provide shelter for the homeless. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, Los Angeles, you know, touts itself as being a very liberal, progressive, moving forward kind of area, and it's really not when it comes to the homelessness. And there's a history to it, but we'll talk about that in a little bit later. Let's go back to your question about where does all this money go?
Well, and all of these places that I mentioned have put not millions, but billions of dollars towards this problem, and the problem is not better. So it really begs the question of the accountability for the money that people either vote to use for a certain purpose, mm-hmm. or that the legislators decide to use for a certain purpose. Where is the accounting for that money?
Well, I think that's a good question.
And who has to report where each dollar went, because taxpayers, that's those taxpayers' money. It used to be our money. It no longer is, because we no longer live there, although we still have a business there, so it is our money too. But the people need to hold these politicians accountable for where that money went, because when you vote, Ron, and you say, yes, you're telling me that we have this huge homeless problem in Los Angeles, and we're going to give you $1.2 billion to build 10,000 housing units for these people, and 4 years later, you've done nothing about it, where is that money? And my concern, and everybody's concern, should be that they're playing some kind of a shell game with your money.
Well, I don't think that's out of the ordinary compared to what's happened across the United States, and especially with the federal government and Congress do with the money that they suck out of everybody's taxes. But, you know, here's something that's interesting, at least in Los Angeles County, and that is, not only are they taxing the residents, but they're also taxing people that build in the city and county of Los Angeles. So Los Angeles has put a developer's tax into place. So, and that, just that alone, is going to generate $100 million per year. $100 million per year, that's on top of the $4.6 billion that the voters put on themselves. Okay, so they didn't, that wasn't something that was forced on them. That went into like an initiative, a voting initiative for the city, and the voters voted on that. So they approved the $4.6 billion.
So besides needing to know where the money goes, because that, we're talking about big black holes here where this money's going, and there's something very seriously wrong with that, because the homeless situation not only is not being helped, but it's getting worse.
You just can't see, you know what? You just, here's my problem. I can't see the money being spent. You know? I can't
see. Well, not on this.
I can't see it. In other words, show me something on television. Take me to a place where you have taken a building, you know, like an apartment building, a giant apartment building, or you've converted a giant office building into residences for homeless people. Show me hundreds of tiny houses out on city land that you've put out there for homeless people. Show me what you're doing. Show me that the streets are clean.
You know,
and they smell better.
And I'm gonna, I agree with you, but I'm gonna disagree with you on that a little bit, because I don't think that the answer is throwing housing at people.
Oh, I don't agree. I don't either. I'm just making that comment.
So I think that as I think about this issue, here's how it comes down to for me, and it's just common sense. And it seems like our legislators have no common sense. So at some point in time, Ron, the politicians in these cities decided that in some misguided way that they were being compassionate to people. And this is absolutely backed up and helped by activist judges who decide that, you know, these people and the ACLU and that these people have rights that, you know, that they really don't have. And what has happened is, in my opinion, comes down to exactly one word, and that's accountability. And it's always a big word with me because it's where we are failing everything in our society right now. So what we've done is we have allowed these people to make these encampments, and we have disallowed law enforcement from doing anything about it. Go ahead.
You know, one of the things that we talked about, you know, this morning over breakfast is, you know, why is it the way it is now? Why is it like this now? And there's no easy answers to it. But I agree with you. I mean, you refer to it as accountability, and I think that's a good word. I refer to everything as being behaviorally oriented because I'm a behaviorist. And so it's always behavior. And it is,
but when
you're
you
right.
hold people accountable,
well, but you're right.
that changes behavior.
Well, no. That's why I think your word of accountability is actually better than mine. Mine is the behavior creates these situations, but the lack of accountability maintains them. So here's a great example. Historically, in 2006, when Bill Bratton, who was the former police commissioner in New York City,
yes.
got hired by Los Angeles, City of Los Angeles, and I have to tell you, I personally met him once in a training in Los Angeles Police Department. I thought he was a phenomenal chief of police. He's just an extremely intelligent guy. I've got a lot of respect for Bill Bratton. Not on everything, but I think he's a hell of a leader. In 2006, he took the whole concept of broken windows that was there when Giuliani was mayor of New York City, and Bill Bratton was the PC.
Which is how New York got cleaned up.
Exactly.
So for anybody that wouldn't understand what broken windows is, it basically says that you prosecute even the smallest crimes. You prosecute jaywalking, you prosecute vagrancy, you prosecute loitering, you prosecute littering. You throw a cigarette butt, you're going to get in trouble.
Well, you know, and what it's referred to as quality of life crimes,
mm-hmm.
and where the whole broken window thing, and I'm sure you know this, but where the whole broken window term came from is that, and it was from a criminologist, I don't remember his name, but the criminologist said, you know, when you go past a building and there's one broken window, and if you don't repair that window, the next day or the next week, there'll be two broken windows,
yes.
and three broken windows, and five broken windows. And if you don't touch it, pretty soon there'll be graffiti on the building, and they'll burn it down, or there'll be thousands of broken windows. And so every time there is a quality of life crime, and you mentioned a whole bunch of them, and you don't address that, which is a behavioral issue, then people feel entitled to continue that behavior.
And they escalate behavior.
You're absolutely right. Now, you and I, because we've done this job, we've been there, we've both been ground pounders, we understand how this works. To other people that don't understand criminology, they don't understand behavior, they don't understand this, they look at things like, man, I can't believe that you would write a guy a ticket for throwing a cigarette butt down on the ground, or for littering, or for jaywalking. What we're trying to do is we're not trying to punish people. What we're trying to do is modify bad behavior.
Yes. Yes.
We're trying to, you know, think of the littering as breaking a window. Right. Think of the petty thefts as breaking a window. Think about urination, public urination and defecation as broken windows. And then if you don't do anything about that, you get what Los Angeles has now. Now, what happened to Bill Bratton's great idea of broken windows? The same thing that happened in the city of New York now. And that is, people came in, like the ACLU, and they filed lawsuits, civil rights lawsuits, against the city, against the police department. And son of a gun, if federal judges didn't uphold those lawsuits. Now, here's a great one. Why are people camping in all these cities, right? We'll just pick California. They're camping there because the Ninth Circuit made a ruling that said, at least for Los Angeles, if you don't build shelters for homeless people, then you can't tag them, you know, cite them and remove them for sleeping on city streets.
But see, they are going against what the rule of law says.
It is nuts.
In the state.
It's nuts.
And that's where you get these activist judges basically changing the laws that people vote for. Now, back about 5 years ago, California, they approved Proposition 47.
Oh, yes.
Proposition horrible. 47 was horrible. It reduced the penalties for some of the crimes that were nonviolent and non-serious crimes.
And felony crimes.
Right.
Exactly.
But again, it goes totally against the whole broken window scenario, where now you have basically given people permission to commit crimes that now have become misdemeanors that used to be felonies, or things like fraud, grand theft, shoplifting, most illegal drugs for personal use are decriminalized, and they're not being prosecuted. That is where you get the escalation of things happening.
You know, I agree with you entirely. And I want to go back to like public urination and public defecation for a second. I know those are kind of ugly things to talk about, but I think they're important because it's a huge health issue. You would not see people taking a leak in public or taking a dump in public because they knew they were going to get cited, they knew they were going to get arrested, they knew that this was not tolerated in society. And so once the courts started ruling the way we've discussed ruling, now you have the poop chart in San Francisco. I mean, that's the end result. You know, you always talk about the law of unintended consequences. That's the end. Now you've got everything smelling like urine and everything smelling like feces, and now that's where you're getting, you know, the problems with cholera and typhus and, you know, and all these different things.
Well, these city attorneys, Ron, and these politicians, in their misguided compassion, they thought that they would save money by sending fewer people to jail by decriminalizing all of these things. Well, they've actually created the opposite. And I want to talk more about that in a couple of minutes.
Well, let's have a cup of coffee and we'll come back and hit that nail on the head.
Spreading the outlaw truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Got my coffee and I'm ready to go.
I'm right with you.
Okay. So I want to talk more about why I think that this is happening, as well as a lot of experts. So when we decriminalize these crimes, Ron, it really encourages people, or it allows them to slide more into using more drugs, or, you know, if they don't have consequences in the first place from using the drugs, then they're going to... I have to laugh because the dog is over there eating, and that's what dogs do.
She's slurping water.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm with you. Go ahead.
But they tend to commit more of the crime. So if they don't get prosecuted for theft when they steal something in a store, they're going to do it again. When they don't get prosecuted for having drugs, they're going to have more drugs. And it's a slippery slope that we have created, and under the auspices of compassion. And that compassion doesn't work for the everyday other citizens who are affected by the crimes of those people. And those people that are homeless in front of their businesses and that are, you know, really preventing them from doing business.
Well, you know, there was a, you know, taking that on, there was a really interesting YouTube video that was posted in Sacramento, and I do a lot of work in Sacramento, and it was posted by a gal that has owned a hair salon in downtown Sacramento. And she said, I've had it. I've had enough. I'm paying a lot of rent here. I have a lot of customers. But every single day before I start my job, first of all, I get scared because I have to go past all these homeless people and these crazies and all these, you know, drug abusers and all these people just to get to my front door. And I have to tell people to move out of my doorway. Okay, just take your tent, take all your stuff, and move out of my doorway. But then the next thing I have to do is I have to clean up their poop. And I have to clean up their needles and their condoms. And I have to then get water and a hose. And I have to literally hose down the whole front of my storefront because it smells like urine and wine and vomit and defecation. And she says, I'm losing customers and I just can't be here anymore. So I gave the landlord notice, and I'm moving, you know, out of the downtown area. And I put a lot of money investing in infrastructure in my salon to make it look like a really nice place, and I just can't do that anymore. And you're seeing so many business people that are talking about that, and the business people are the heart and soul of any downtown
area. And they
are
the ones that are supporting the downtown area and paying the taxes and bringing people in to buy in that area. And we are destroying our inner cities.
But you know, Linda, I want to, you touched on something when you're saying that these advocacy groups and the ACLU, the people that file these lawsuits against, you know, law enforcement and health services, you know, who are trying to help these people, and they are preventing us from institutionalizing people that need to be institutionalized. They are filing lawsuits preventing the mandatory, you know, taking of psychotropic medications, you know, basically forcing people to take medication to make themselves better. And they think they're helping these people, and they're not. They're actually killing these people.
They're killing the people, and they're hurting society as a whole. And we don't have lawmakers and politicians and legislators that we vote for to hurt us. That just goes against everything that, you know, that the whole job is about. Yet they are making these decisions that are hurting the good people in favor of the people that are in dire straits in life.
Well, yeah, and it's a little bit like what we talked about the other night, where they don't want to call it what it is. They want to have some feel-good terms, or it goes right back to your thing about accountability. You know, when we talked about the city and county just the other night of San Francisco, and they're changing the word convicted felon.
Yes.
And they're changing it to some feel-good word that's vague and ambiguous, like returning resident or, you know, justice-involved person. It doesn't speak to what it is, and it doesn't address behavior. And the more we look the other way, the more we try to find some touchy-feely, you know, slogan or some other language about, you know, what you call things, the less accountability takes place, and the more the problem worsens.
Well, I agree. And Curtis Hill is an attorney general that wrote an article that I thought was a brilliant article, and he addressed a lot of these issues. And one of the things that he said in his article is, can policies that make things intolerably worse for everyone really be called compassionate? And this is where I'm telling you that these politicians are so misguided, the judges, the attorneys that are fighting these battles for the people that are, I don't want to say the least of us, that, because that is not what I mean by that, but the people that are the most troubled of us.
Right, I think that's a good way
yeah,
to put it.
The most
yeah.
troubled of us.
People going through the most stuff.
And there are solutions to this, and the first solution has to be that people be held accountable for their actions, and it doesn't matter how small the actions are. I totally agree with the broken windows policing, and that's what we should be going back to, because we have proven beyond a reasonable doubt here that doing otherwise does not work. So when you have these people, they're there for several reasons, right, Ron?
Right.
So they're there either because they're mentally ill.
Which is a big one. But the biggest one, I think, is drug addiction.
Drugs and alcohol addiction.
Right. Which, by the way, which leads to mental health problems.
Sure. And number three would be just, you know, there's just people who don't want to work that just want to feed off the system. And that's a portion of those people as well.
And sure. And along with all of these people outside of the mental health people, but with the people that are drug addicted or alcohol addicted or self-medicating with alcohol or drugs, or people that don't want to work, people that want to live off the dole, those are all poor decisions that they've made in their life.
Yes.
They haven't educated themselves. They haven't gotten job training skills. They don't want to get job training skills. They don't want education. They're getting used to the government dole and being on welfare and getting paid for this type of thing. Again, that's behavioral, and you're never going to start getting to solutions unless you identify all the different people and what their different issues are, and then you have impact strategies and programs to funnel those people into. The one last thing I want to say, one of the big things that all of these politicians are doing, and it's a huge mistake, is what I refer to as warehousing. Okay, so, you know, you spend $1 billion and then you take just a whole bunch of people and you think that you're going to get rid of the problem by putting, you know, 5,000 tiny houses out there somewhere and just warehousing those people in the tiny houses. You're not doing anything. You're just horizontally moving those people. You're not dealing with the issues, and they'll be back and we'll have a worse problem.
Well, and here's how I think that the issues could be dealt with. And I think that Attorney General Curtis Hill has the same opinion. We just probably say it in a different way. But if you take the people, Ron, and the money that we have talked about, the billions of dollars, instead of throwing it at the problem, which actually I don't think that they are. I think that that money is getting siphoned off elsewhere because we don't see any results. So go back to building mental health institutions and staffing them that will take care of the percentage of people that are on the street that have mental health problems. And the ACLU and the judges are going to have to butt out of this in the way that they must understand that for the greater public good, they need to address this problem with the people's mental illnesses. And that is what true compassion would be for those people.
Well, you know, I don't disagree at all, and actually I take it a bit farther, because we almost develop what's referred to as a special relationship with these people. So when you have people that have serious mental health problems, they're gravely disabled, they're a danger to themselves, they're a danger to other people, and we don't do anything about that, and it causes these people to get worse. And because they are gravely disabled, they are a danger to themselves or others, these people get into trouble. They get into trouble with law enforcement. They get into trouble with other citizens. They get into trouble with each other, and they get injured and they get killed. And we are not addressing our special relationship. Now, in actuality, the term special relationship comes from you know, the correction system, where, you know, you have somebody in custody and they can't go to the hospital on their own, or they can't do this, they can't seek medical attention. And so you're the person, because you've put them in custody, that's the relationship you have. But to me, I really don't see much of a difference, because yes, they're not in custody, but mentally, in their minds, they're in custody. Well, they're broken people.
They are
and
broken.
They can't, here's the key to me, for me, they can't take care of themselves. So if we are calling ourselves a society here, then we have a responsibility, and the judges can't have it both ways, okay? The judges can't say, well, we're going to let people live on the streets because you had a responsibility to shelter them and you didn't do it. Wait a minute. As far as the mental health people are concerned, we want to shelter them in institutions where they can get help daily. They can get medication. They can get therapy. They can get people watching over them so they don't hurt themselves and don't hurt others. That's the type of relationship we want to have.
And so that they're not out there getting typhus.
Exactly.
And they're not out there getting raped. And they're not out there getting hurt.
And I can't understand why these judges can't put two and two together like that and look at sheltering in a different, higher level.
Which is more compassionate,
exactly,
is my question. You think you're being compassionate and you think you're protecting people's civil rights, but you're actually
hurting them,
damning those people to a horrible life. Desi agrees. The other thing, the second component of this, in my mind, is the people with drug and alcohol abuse problems who are living on the street. So those people, I mean, in my mind, they need to be arrested for whatever crimes that they have. So if they're drug crimes, they need to be arrested. And again, you have billions of dollars, and when they say that they're saving money by keeping them out of jails, I say build more jails, build more prisons, and in those jails and prisons, you must provide them with ways for them to get off the drugs and some sort of rehabilitation and job training. And then you work with the community that when these people come out, that there are people that are willing to hire them.
Right.
And this is how you solve this problem. But you cannot just decriminalize these things and leave them out on the street.
Oh, no, I totally agree with you. And the way that I think about it is sort of an upper level tough love. Okay, where it's sort of a forced parenting.
Absolutely.
Because they've abrogated their own responsibilities, and we've done nothing but empower them by and enabling them by making, you know, certain drugs legal, or possession of drugs or use of drugs legal now. In other words, we've decriminalized it, so we've made it legal. So when you do that, and compounded by the whole legalized marijuana thing, which has been an abject failure in the state of California, because it is a gateway drug. I don't care what anybody says. Talk to any toxicologist and they'll tell you that. This is not rocket science. But what we've done is we've enabled these people, we've empowered these people, and we've made it worse for these people.
Yes.
And you know, a jail, whatever, it has to be a custodial setting where they're there. And we know they're there every day, and there's accountability, like you say, and then we can work on rehabilitating them. We can work on, you know, the drug and alcohol syndromes, problems that they have, and break that cycle of addiction and get them some education, get them some job training skills, and then have a source, an employment source to send them to, so we don't have this cycle over and over and over again. And again, it's compassionate. People look at it like, oh my God, that's terrible. You're going to, wait a minute, we're talking about people here that are pretty much not contributing at all and causing problems for the rest of the people like us in society that have to put up with them, that have to deal with them and their issues.
And what about those people's rights in their businesses and those people's rights in their homes to not have this type of a situation, this type of a health hazard, this type of a violent crime hazard, this type of drug hazards that are all around them in their own spaces? One of the things that President Ronald Reagan said that I totally agree with, Ron, was we must reject the idea that every time a law is broken, society is guilty rather than the lawbreaker. It is time to restore the American precept that each individual is accountable for his actions. And I totally agree with that. It still applies today. And we've kind of gone in the opposite direction. So when you have cities that basically welcome people to be homeless, what do you think you're going to get? You get Portland, you get Seattle, you get Los Angeles, you get San Francisco. These are cities that nobody even wants to go in at this point in time. And again, there's so much money that's being thrown at this, or purportedly thrown at this. Again, I don't believe it. I don't know where the money is because we don't see anything. But let's take those billions of dollars. Let's build some mental facilities that will help these people that need it. Let's build some more jails and prisons that will help the people who that need to be imprisoned or need to be in jail for a while. And in those jails and in those prisons, we need to put programs that help them with the drugs, that help them with, you know, job skills. And that is where the money should be going, because throwing it at the problem has done nothing but make it worse. And it's so completely unfair to the citizens of these cities.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, you're talking about, you know, this thing, we're talking about homelessness. And of course, you know, my whole career, I've been involved with the criminal justice system, and, you know, I've been to just more than my share of prisons. And this is what's remarkable for me is reminding myself of, you know, some of my visits to prisons where they had all sorts of rehabilitation programs that, you know, wood shop and electrical and air conditioning and heating and auto shop and cabinetry making. I mean, you name it. They had all of these different things. And I can remember a few years ago, I was up in Pelican Bay, way up in, you know, Crescent City area in Northern California at the Oregon border. And of course, Pelican Bay is one of our very worst prisons. Is, I mean, in other words, it has like the worst of the worst in there. But they had all these rehabilitation programs there, and not a single one of them had inmates there. And it wasn't because the inmates didn't want to go to them. It's because the state had shut them down for funding. Okay? They didn't have the funding. And so I never understood that. Wait a minute. Do you realize how much money it costs when these people go back out on the street? They go back to their neighborhoods, and they have no job skills, they have no education, and they get back right into where they started off. And it's this perpetual cycle of tragedy. And the stuff that the state of California just throws money away at, when you talk about the bullet train, you talk about illegal aliens, you talk about all this crap that the state of California wastes tens of billions of dollars on. And here you have something where you've got people that need to be rehabilitated, they need to become productive members of society, and all you do is change their name. You don't change their circumstance, you just change your name, and you change it to something that sounds better, like, you know, returning resident or something like that, and you've done nothing to move that person forward.
Well, they're completely misguided in their compassion. Their compassion is opposite of compassion. So I think it's a bigger discussion. I want to talk more about it. Right now I need another cup of coffee.
Okay, here we go. This is Dr. Ron Martinelli, forensic criminologist and host of A Thread of Evidence on America Out Loud. If you'd like to find out what forensic criminologists really do in the field, and you're tired of the false narratives about law enforcement and want to unpack the cases that I've worked throughout the nation, then please pick up a copy of my new book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, on sale right now at Amazon.com. That's The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police at Amazon.com.
Tired of watching the same old sporting events? Well, kick it up a notch and get ready, America, for something you've never seen before. It's the new generation of Western superstars. Shorty Gorham's American freestyle bullfighting. Who will win? The acrobatic, tough-as-nails Western superstar or the meanest half-ton fighting bulls on Earth? This is one of the most extreme sports you'll ever see in an arena. This is hand-to-horn combat on a level playing field. Go to ShortyGorhamAFB.com or find them on Facebook. It's bullfighting time.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good taste in gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company Healthy Cell will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud, or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com.
All right, well, we're heading into our last cup of coffee for the evening, and I wanted to just, you know, we've been talking about California, but, I mean, full disclosure, this deals with all of the cities across the United States, because we go, I mean, you and I travel so much, and we go to all these big cities, and we see the problems in other states as well, but we don't see it anywhere. Would you agree we don't see it anywhere to the level that we see it in the state of California?
Well, I think yes, but I think Seattle and Portland are right there with it. And, you know, we don't have this big of a problem like in New York, so a lot of it is still, it seems like when Giuliani was mayor there, you know, whatever he did, even though Cuomo's trying to, his hardest to wreck it over there, and we're going to talk about him in a minute, I think that they don't have the same homeless issue that these guys in California and Seattle and Portland have.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We go to Chicago maybe about once a year. We go mm-hmm. to Chicago, and I love Chicago because of the architecture and the food.
Yes.
The food is really good there, and you know, around the whole Michigan Avenue, around the giant park and the Naval Center, you know, the Navy Center out there, and you just don't see it. Now, I'm not saying it because you could go to Racine, you could go a lot of other places, the suburbs of Chicago, obviously South Side Chicago, where they have so many problems and so much gun crime and so much drug abuse there and gangs and everything. But you don't see it in the downtown area of Chicago.
Yeah, well, they definitely have.
And I think it's
problems,
from the Daily. I think it's from the Mayor Daley days.
I don't think that they have a huge homeless problem. They do have a huge gang problem there.
Yeah.
But
you know,
homeless.
The other thing, though, and I think the West Coast is so different than when you go to the Midwest and everything. And part of the reason is, I mean, quite frankly, is the weather.
Sure.
Okay, because you're going to freeze to death in Chicago.
Yes, you are.
You're going to freeze to death in Detroit.
Yeah.
You're going to freeze to death in New York City.
Yeah.
So you don't see it like you see in Santa Barbara or in Los Angeles or San Diego and these more, you know, temperate climates. But anyway, I mean, I just wanted to say, full disclosure, yeah, we're banging a lot on California. But we're actually talking about major cities all around the country because all the same problems are national problems. Okay, switching gears for a second, but going back to the state we love to hate, and it's California. And I just saw today where the California Assembly voted to allow 17-year-olds to vote in primary and special elections. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that had a caveat on it that they have to be 18 by the time the actual election day happens.
That's correct. And it's not going to affect this coming year's election. So it's not going to affect the 2020 election for president and, you know, the other, you know, national elected offices, Congress and the Senate. But I'll give you a great example. We were in HEB today. And I went over because, you know, we had our big jar of coins, right? So I take the big jar of coins and I take it to the machine and, you know, I put the coins in the machine and it tells me how much money. It gives me a voucher and I walk over to customer service and turn in my voucher to get some cash. And there were two really nice young ladies that were there and they were both in their early 20s. And one of the bills that the gal handed me was a $50 bill. And I said to her, after I took the bill, I said to her, can you tell me whose face is on a $50 bill? And she said, no. And I said, really? You handle money every day? And she says, yeah, I do. I said, well, can you tell me whose face is on a $20 bill? No. Who's on a $5 bill? No. I said, okay. I started asking her just some really easy questions about presidents of the United States and what they did and what they're known for. And she didn't know a single answer to any question. Neither did the other gal that was with her. And then I said, you know, this particular president is on a bill because not only was he an important president, but he was one of the founding fathers. And I said, do you know what the founding fathers are? And she said, no. And I said, they don't really don't teach you about history, do they? And they said, no, they really didn't in school. This is the level of people that we're getting. Then these people are in their 20s. Well, we're talking about people that are 17 years old.
That's a whole other sort of subject with me is our educational system. We talk about it all the time, how they've taken history and civics out of the history books so that people don't know it, so that they don't have a country to defend, you know, when the time comes to defend us. But, you know, speaking of our country, there was just a really interesting survey done that I want to tell you about because the results to me were surprising, but not. So the top 10 governors in the country rated by approval ratings in their states. Okay.
Okay.
So if they rate all the governors and they rate them by 5,000 people like every week. This survey is put on by a company called Morning Consult, and it's a global technology and media company. So what they found is actually more than the top 10, but the top 15 governors in the country, every single one of them is Republican. This is a nonpartisan organization, and they simply chart the popularity of the governors in each state, and they do it very frequently. So I just thought it was so interesting that the 15 most popular governors in the country are Republican. And I'll tell you, the first most popular governor is Charlie Baker, who is the governor in Massachusetts, and he is a Republican governor in a very Democratic state.
You know, what's interesting is I do not know that governor, but you and I know our governor, Greg Abbott, and to me, he's the most fascinating politician in a good way, the most positive, fascinating, intelligent governor that I've ever met in my entire life.
Well, and okay. he's at the top of the list as well.
Okay, I hope he's in there.
He definitely is in there at the top of the list. And another one is Maryland's governor. Again, a state that tends to be more Democratic, but he's Republican, Larry Hogan, and New Hampshire governor Chris Sununu. And Chris Sununu is very, very popular. They have all three of those people have extremely high rate approval ratings amongst their voters. And I want to tell you who the other ones are because I think it's really interesting. So there's Phil Scott, a Republican in Vermont.
And oh, I see him on television from time to time. He's pretty smart.
Yep. Doug Burgum, a Republican in North Dakota. Mark Gordon in Wyoming. Asa Hutchinson in, I believe that's Arkansas.
Right. You see her on television from time to time.
Greg Abbott, our own Greg Abbott. Ron DeSantis in Florida, which I'm really glad to see that he's on this list. And Kay Ivey in Alabama. Now, I will say this about Kay Ivey. Her ratings have dropped since she banned abortion for almost anything, even in cases of rape or incest. So her ratings have dropped, but she's still in the top 15 in the country. Every single one of those being a Republican governor, I think that's fascinating.
Well, you know what's fascinating, but you know what, and you and I do get into politics, you know, all the time. But I want to just sort of take politics out of it and talk about these governors and what makes a good governor. And I don't care what your political persuasion is. What makes a good governor for a state? And I know the California governors, and we've been lucky enough to personally meet Governor Abbott, and we've had lunch with Governor Abbott, and we've been in town halls with Governor Abbott. And just talking about Governor Abbott as a man, you can't help but respect this guy, all right, because this guy has got his finger on the pulse of everything that happens in Texas. When we went to that lunch a few weeks ago in San Antonio. And there were, I think there were probably about 80 people in that room. And they were asking him questions. And I mean, those questions.
Random questions.
Random questions, yep, out of left field. And this guy never dodged a single question. And he had an answer to every single one of those questions. Somebody asked him about some lake that is not too far away from where we live. And I go, okay, well, let's see if he's got an answer to this one. And he was right on top of
it. Because Texas is a huge state and it's a lot of territory to know everything about. But he's very, very engaged. The governors who didn't fare well, Ron, in the study, so we're talking about the bottom governors out of all the states. So out of the bottom 10, 7 are Democrat, 3 are Republican.
Okay.
And I'm not going to give them in any particular order, although I will say that the Kentucky governor, Matt Bevin, who is a Republican, who is up for re-election, is the least popular. Okay, and I don't know the reason for that.
Okay, but some of those things is what we really should find out and come back and have a conversation about that. Because me, I don't want to look at I want to look at popularity, but I want to know why they're popular.
Well, I don't really
care whether they're Republicans or they're Democrats. I want to know why a politician is so popular with their electorate. To me, it gives an indication of leadership. And again, I mean, I keep saying things about Greg Abbott because I know what leadership is. I've seen leadership and I've seen poor leadership, and he is on the very high end of real leadership in my book. I have tremendous respect for that guy. And it's because he is so, what's the word? Customer service oriented?
Sure. He is. He's engaged in everything that goes on in the state.
And he doesn't talk like a politician.
No, he's a very, very kind and nice man. So let's talk about those voters who disapprove of their governors. And we're talking about Ned Lamont, who's a Democrat in Connecticut. Matt Bevin, again, he's a Republican in Kentucky. He's at the bottom of the list. Gina Raimondo, who is in Rhode Island, a Democrat. Kate Brown, a Democrat in Oregon. Now, you can understand in Oregon because you have Portland. And you understand that the people are very, very unhappy there with the homeless situation.
The people in Connecticut are very unhappy about their governor there because their taxes are, I think it's the third highest state in the United States. I think California, New York, and then I think it's Connecticut as far as taxation is concerned. And they have some serious problems in some of their big cities. Hartford is a terrible city.
And then you have, in Virginia, you have Ralph Northam. He is a Democrat. In California, you have Gavin Newsom.
How far down is Gavin Newsom? Because they're already talking about recalling that guy, and he just got elected.
Well, right now, his approval ratings as of this week is 43% approved and 33%
don't.
Surprised it's that high, too.
Right.
We'll see how that comes out. West Virginia, Jim Justice, again, a Republican. Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat in Michigan. J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat in Illinois, again, a place that is very troubled with Chicago and with the crime problems there. So you can see why people would be unhappy. And Phil Murphy in New Jersey, which, again, probably a lot of that comes down to the tax issues.
Well, you know, the other thing is that, and we just had a conversation and you came up with the list of the worst states. And New Jersey was right at the top of that. I think it was like in the number 3 or number 4 position of the worst states in the United States, according to that 1.5 million people poll. So a lot of people don't like what's going on in New Jersey, and I know that's been for a long time.
Yeah, it was even when they had a Republican governor. So, yeah, but it's interesting to note, I think, just that the Republicans tend to be more law and order. They tend to be more holding people accountable. They tend to be, I think, in a lot of cases, not all, but they tend to be somewhat better on the finances. And I think that that's why we're getting the results we're getting.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think would be kind of neat to do, and we probably, between you and I, have enough time to to do some research on that. I'd like to take a look. You know, we've been talking about, Los Angeles, and we've been talking about San Francisco and Portland and Seattle. Those are all run by Democratic administration, Chicago Democratic administration, New York Democratic administration. What I'd like to try to do is I'd like to find some cities that are run by Republican administrations or conservative administrations and take a look and compare and contrast to see if there are Republican or conservative-run cities and communities that have the type of homeless problems that we see in the Democratic side or these other crime problems. And I'd like to see if not just the issue of conservative versus liberal has something to do with it, but the politics and the policies of Democratic administrations versus Republican or more conservative administrations, if that matters in the overall safety, security, and economics of these big cities.
You know, it would be interesting, and I'm sure that we can find some data on that. It's interesting to me that Gavin Newsom has not been governor that long in California, and already the people are, they're starting to rebel against some of these things. So in the cities that you and I have talked about tonight, again, the Portland, the Seattle, the San Francisco, and the Los Angeles, the residents are starting to finally wake up and complain. And again, people can only change these situations with their votes. And this is where they need to vote out a Garcetti, vote out a Gavin Newsom, vote out these mayors and the governors in these cities that are allowing this kind of mess to go on, and understand that the way to get this fixed is the compassionate way, is not to throw money at it. It is to help actually fix this and get the people off the street.
And, you know, I think that a very interesting ethnographic study that would be, I think, very illuminating would be to go into these major cities, into these core areas, and to talk to the voters that have voted for these mayors and these city councils, where these cities have just become abject failures and safety and security risks, and find out, why did you vote for these people? And would you vote for them again? And what was the line? If there was a red line, what's your red line as to what you will tolerate when you live in these cities? Because when you take a look at like the city of San Francisco, there's a lot of intelligent, educated people there.
Sure.
And they pay a lot of money to live in the
and
city of San
Seattle.
Francisco.
Extremely intelligent people up there.
And so has your red line been crossed yet? Or, you know, what are your feelings? So anyway, so I think that that's good pause for a future common sense conservative coffee conversation. Are you ready for bed?
I am.
Here we go.
Okay.